Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Schon viel über Kryptowährungen gehört, aber noch keinen richtigen Zugang gefunden? Der Einstieg in Kryptowährungen muss nicht kompliziert sein. Mit Xtrackers ETCs kannst du kostengünstig in die Zukunft investieren. Einfach übers klassische Depot. Auf xtrackers.de findest du viel Wissenswertes zu dieser spannenden Anlageklasse. Nimm deine finanzielle Zukunft selbst in die Hand. Schritt für Schritt mit Xtrackers. Investitionen unterliegen Risiken. Dieser Beitrag ist eine Werbemitteilung der DWS International GmbH, Frankfurt.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Namaste, I'm Dabina Gupta. And on this edition this Friday, we are talking about are consumers back in the American market? We decode the fresh consumer data for you. Also, why are thousands of workers preparing to go on a strike at ports in the East Coast of the US? Also, the fallout of high gold prices on the global economy.
As the gold price goes up, it means gold jewelry is more expensive, and that will hamper, at least in the short term, jewelry demand from some countries.
So from electric vehicles to gold to consumer sentiments, all wrapped up on this World Business Report. Let's start. From today, a range of Chinese goods entering the US will have to pay a steep tariff. The Biden administration has imposed a 50% duty on solar cells, 25% on steel, aluminium, EV batteries and key minerals. But perhaps the steepest tariff of all is a 100% duty on electric vehicles to protect the American auto industry. So what's the immediate impact of it? I spoke with Seth Weintraub. He founded the website Electric, which closely follows the global EV industry.
It means that vehicles made outside of China, specifically North American vehicles, are going to be much more competitive in the marketplace. China is putting out vehicles for just around $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 that compete with $30,000 vehicles in the U.S. So putting a 100% tariff on those makes everything more competitive.
How big is the share of Chinese EVs in American market?
It's not very big right now. It certainly could grow without these tariffs, and it probably will grow even with the tariffs. But right now, there's the Polestar 2 is made in China. There's just a few vehicles that are made in China, and those will see huge price increases because of this. One notable vehicle, the Volvo, the EX30, was going to be made in China, but because of this tariff news, they've shifted production to their Belgian factory to make vehicles for the U.S. market. So they've actually shifted all of their production for the U.S. into Europe. And ironically, because Europe hasn't switched into high tariff mode yet, they're going to get Chinese vehicles into Europe. So it's kind of a shifting priorities there.
Well, this is interesting because do you see more Chinese electric vehicle companies then trying to reroute their entry to the US? Could some of them, say, come from Mexico, for example, just to avoid these tariffs?
That's absolutely right. And we've heard already that BYD is looking at factories in Mexico and could happen in other places as well. It makes a lot of sense. The supply chain that China has, it makes vehicles very inexpensive. So shifting that supply chain to a closer market like Mexico has already shown in other markets to be productive. So in the car market, I think it'll work as well.
So overall then, are these tariffs largely symbolic?
No, I don't think they're symbolic. I do think they're going to have a positive effect on the U.S. market. We're all taught in school that tariffs are not great, but also the Chinese have been subsidizing their manufacturing for quite some time. So it's not quite fair. This levels the playing field to a certain degree.
But why is it that American companies cannot compete with cheaper Chinese cars? What will it take to make American companies more competitive in a free market then?
We're just kind of getting started here in the U.S., so to speak. So hopefully these tariffs give the U.S. market enough incentive and enough time to mature so that they are competitive with China.
But for American consumers, doesn't it block their chance of getting an affordable electric vehicle? And because of that, the transition to electric cars in America, will it slow down?
That's a great point. There's a $10,000 BYD Dolphin that everybody's kind of aghast at because, you know, thousands and millions of people could be driving that EV around cutting emissions. But the reality is that car really doesn't cost $10,000. It costs a lot more to develop and build and make. The Chinese government has subsidized that to a pretty big extent. So that's the debate. I mean, the same thing could be said for solar panels. We have a 25% going to 50% tariff on solar panels. It would be nice if cheaper solar panels were available to everybody. It would certainly help with the greenhouse gases.
Well, Europe has also imposed tariffs on these Chinese electric cars. But of course, it's lower than the U.S. How do you read that?
I believe that Europe is going to catch up with the U.S. just like Canada recently announced they're going to go to 100%. I think Europe's going to 100% as well. They have the same issues. They have a car market there that can't be competitive with the Chinese prices. So it's protectionist, but it's protectionist against a country that's been subsidizing the development of their EV supply chain for some time now.
How do you think China would retaliate now?
I don't know how they will. There's a few options, moving all their manufacturing to Mexico, you know, build 80% of the car in China and then put the last few pieces together somewhere else, maybe even in the U.S. There's lots of ways to get around tariffs, obviously.
That's electric vehicle industry analysis, Sait Weintraub, joining me from the U.S. But the question is, are these tariffs symbolic? Because the U.S. imports almost no Chinese electric vehicles. It's quite negligible. So earlier we spoke with Scott Paul, the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. My colleague Rob Young asked him earlier that if the U.S. government was right to slap tariffs.
This is not an inconsequential part of the U.S. economy. I mean, auto production accounts and its supply chain accounts for about 3% of our gross domestic product. So it is not trivial. This has serious economic consequences.
And to those critics who say this is protectionism, it is isolationism, why not just outcompete the Chinese manufacturers? What do you say?
It's not a level playing field. You have the Chinese government, which have heavily subsidized these companies for a number of years, provided a captive market for them, and then has built up productive capacity that it can't possibly absorb at home, and it's looking to sell those vehicles abroad. And so we would be bailing out Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party. This has nothing to do with free market fundamentals. I think that the Biden-Harris administration is right to install these barriers. I think the EU has been right to look at this. I think Canada, same situation.
That was the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, Scott Paul, speaking to my colleague Rob Young there. We also have George Conboy joining us now, who is a program guest, a friend from Brighton Securities. George, thanks for joining us. Could you just give your analysis to this question, whether these tariffs are actually symbolic? Because in total, they're impacting about $18 billion worth of Chinese goods, which many would say is a drop in the ocean.
It's true, Davina, and partly they are symbolic. About a third of that $18 billion represents a whole category of goods of which we import relatively few from China. However, two-thirds represent lithium-ion batteries, and that's a big component into a lot of electrical goods, and that's a meaningful piece of this tariff. So we could see higher costs for goods containing lithium-ion batteries from China. That's not symbolic. Two-thirds, or about $13 billion. Big numbers.
Big numbers there. But George, stay with us, because let's also talk about what's happening in the East Coast of the U.S. Union trouble brewing at the ports there.
We're preparing for the worst here, but we're hoping for the best. Basically, it does come down to contracts. There's some safety concerns there. Automation drives a lot of this as well. So it's not so much as how much they're going to pay the workers, but automation is a big sticking point. The unions don't want to see heavy automation on the East Coast.
That was Paul Brusher, Vice President of the Global Supply Chain at ITS Logistics in Texas. So what's happening? Well, 10 of the busiest ports in North America are at risk of shutdown next week. That's nearly 45,000 workers who are part of the International Longshoremen's Association, or the ILA, will walk off the job if port operators don't make key concessions on pay and commitments on automation, as we heard earlier from Paul. Now, this becomes a problem for the shipping companies that are rushing to meet holiday orders and have already faced delays because of the Red Sea crisis. On the line from California now with us is Mario Caldero, the CEO of Long Beach Port. It's among the busiest port in America, and it's in the West Coast. So, Mario, thank you for joining us on the show. Could you first tell us, as the East Coast ports, they face a labor strike, has there been a spillover effect on the West Coast of the U.S. and specifically in the port that you're at?
Well, thank you, Davina. With regard to the scenario that we're seeing in the East Coast, if in fact there is a work stoppage, needless to say, more and more shippers are diverting their cargo to the West Coast. But I think the real question is the existential threat to the nation's supply chain. So from my perspective, while you may argue or at first glance say that the West Coast will take advantage of more cargo, for me, that's not a good thing, because I'm thinking the big picture. What is best for the national supply chain? And what is best for the national supply chain, that is my hope that the parties come to an agreement of their differences so that, again, we don't have a disruption in the supply chain.
But right now, what's the impact that you see on the supply chain, especially ahead of the festive season where the shoppers will be going out to buy different things and the products need to be on the shelves on time? What if the strike goes ahead? Will be the delay there?
Well, I think you've indicated that that impact would be that if there is a work stoppage, it's going to disrupt the products going to the shelf, primarily, again, in the East and Gulf portions of the region. And so I think that's for certain negative impact to the supply chain. And but again, my hope is that there is an agreement or at least some solution with regard to how the parties move forward without interrupting cargo movement, we did in the West Coast last year.
Well, the workers right now are also protesting against the automation of ports, but modern technology also brings the cost down for the company. So when you say that there are hopes of negotiations, how do you negotiate this with your workers and what's the way ahead here?
Well, first of all, the ports here, we're a landlord port, so we're not at the table negotiating with the union, as opposed to that's the management component of the maritime employers. But to your question, again, I think we've seen automation to be a constant issue of debate over the many, many years. But fortunately for the West Coast, there was a meeting of the minds how we move forward. And they're experiencing the same thing in the East Coast. So hopefully, again, there's a compromise posture that everybody could come to the table and agree on.
But for your workers, then, will there be longer hours if the strike action goes ahead?
Well, I mean, those of you who know me in terms of what my issue has been, given the COVID-19 global supply chain disruption, back in 2020 or 2021, I've been advocating for 24/7 operations. Now, the reality, we're not going to work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week anytime soon in the United States. However, I think there has to be a real movement to expand hours of operation to, again, make sure that we have the fluidity and movement of cargo as we continue to have this increased cargo numbers over the many years ahead in the West Coast. And that's been the forecast in terms of how cargo is going to continue to increase at the nation's largest gateway here in Long Beach, Los Angeles.
Are you prepared with your current workforce right now? Once there are more people coming to your port, once there are more companies heading to your port for help.
Well, Davina, I can represent to you that our number for the month of August for the Port of Long Beach, we moved 913,000 containers plus. That is a record number in our 113-year history. And we've been able to do that with absolutely no congestion, no bottlenecks, and very good fluidity. And again, all this thankful to the discussions and collaborations we've had with the stakeholders, including truckers, railroads, and carriers. So I'm not concerned with regard to any surge of cargo that we would not be able to handle.
But 24/7 operation also means more costs. Where does that money come from?
Admittedly, yes. But what's the cost of not doing it? We experienced that in COVID-19 with the supply chain disruption and the backlog. I think the costs in a case where you don't move the cargo exceed whatever it costs you invest in making sure we move the cargo.
Mario Caldero, thank you so much for joining us, the CEO of Long Beach Port.
Schon viel über Kryptowährungen gehört, aber noch keinen richtigen Zugang gefunden? Der Einstieg in Kryptowährungen muss nicht kompliziert sein. Mit Xtrackers ETCs kannst du kostengünstig in die Zukunft investieren. Einfach übers klassische Depot. Auf xtrackers.de findest du viel Wissenswertes zu dieser spannenden Anlageklasse. Nimm deine finanzielle Zukunft selbst in die Hand. Schritt für Schritt mit Xtrackers. Investitionen unterliegen Risiken. Dieser Beitrag ist eine Werbemitteilung der DWS International GmbH, Frankfurt.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. New figures out today from the US as well, which shows that the US consumer sentiment continues to rise in late September, reaching a five-month high. The University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index has registered 70.1 as its reading in September, which is slightly up from 67.9 in August. To make sense of these numbers, let's go across to Joanne Hsu, Director of Surveys of Consumers at the University of Michigan. Thanks so much for joining us, Joanne. So does this mean that shoppers are back in the supermarkets to spend those dollars in America?
Well, I think it really remains to be seen how consumers are going to spend going forward. But what I can say is that consumers are feeling a bit more sunny about the economy. They've been feeling pretty down on the economy for the past 2 years because of high inflation. But over this past two-year period, they have noticed that inflation has slowed down. But again, high prices remain a drag on their personal finances and consumers remain frustrated.
What's the reason behind this optimism, though?
There are a couple of factors here. First of all, consumers have noticed the same things that data that the economic data are starting to show this month, that inflation has slowed quite a bit. And they've noticed that completely, and they do expect inflation to continue slowing down in the year ahead. So that's the first factor. And the second factor is that in spite of the fact that they are seeing some signs of softening in the labor market, they expect the Fed to step in with lower interest rates. And that's exactly what happened in the middle of the month. And so consumers see that as a positive factor for the economy. They see that lower interest rates will be good for buying conditions for homes, for large durable goods, and for cars. And they see that as a positive factor for the economy.
Well, we were just talking about that, how there is union trouble brewing in the East Coast. That could mean there could be supply chain delays. There's also elections in the U.S. in the coming months. So how do these factors play in with your forecast for the coming few months?
The election looms large in the minds of American consumers. We ask a number of questions about where consumers think the trajectory of the economy is going. And for many consumers, they tell us that their expectations hinge on the results of the upcoming election. And they tell us often that they expect this person to win, and their responses are assuming that that comes to bear. But if the other candidate wins, then all of their answers would change. So I do think that consumers are making their best forecasts now. But if their forecasts don't become reality come November, they may be altering their expectations for the economy quite quickly after that.
Joanne Hsu, Director, Surveys of Consumers at the University of Michigan. Thanks for joining us. Now, the other data we have been following on World Business Report is actually about the gold prices that have hit a fresh high. George, how are you seeing gold prices right now?
Well, we're up nearly 38% year over year, Davina, and that's driven by demand from a number of sectors and a number of sentiments. Probably the biggest one is investor concern about global instability. You've got a hotly contested election in the U.S. where 50% of the people in the U.S. think that if the other side wins, or I should say 100%, think that if the other side wins, things get worse. You've got a couple of wars going on, Ukraine and the Middle East. And so those kinds of things do tend to drive demand for gold, which is seen as a safe haven in troubled times. Prices are up.
And how are these gold prices then impacting emerging economies and the global economy? Let's break that down. First, let's head to India, where as the global market price hit a record, India's gold imports have also tripled in the month of August, according to the World Gold Council, after the Indian government cut duties from 15% to 16% earlier in the budget. I spoke with Om Saraf, who is the owner of Panalal Om Prakash Jewelers, about how he's seeing this gold price this season ahead of Festival of Diwali in India.
So, see, in this very month of September, in 26 days, the gold has shown a steady increment of nearly 7-8%. It's a very big increment. Even then, despite of this increment, the people are purchasing and showing interest in purchasing. They take it for ornamentation and for a safe investment also.
What sells the most in this season?
The coins for the investment and in the jewelry for the wedding season and other things.
Compared to last Diwali, is the quantity of gold that you bought, is it the same for your purposes of selling it?
No, not the same. It's a bit less. So you may say 10% less.
Why is it less?
Well, after all, there has to be money in pocket for the buyers. And they have a limitation. There are 2-3 classes in India. Affluent people who can afford. That's one class. The other class is the service class people. They have a limitation. Limitation of money and limitation of their needs also. The more vital things they need for their everyday needs, they have to be preferred instead of buying gold.
And how's that impacting your business then, when this service class is not spending as much as it used to?
Demand is there. Hmm. Demand is there. The ongoing festive season is onset. And moreover, the wedding season is also going to start from November. So all the impacts, they will conclude in the demand.
That was a jeweler from India, Om Saraf of Panalal Om Prakash Jewelers. So why is it that gold prices are going up? I spoke with John Reed, senior market strategist at the World Gold Council earlier.
Reason why gold's been going up over the last couple of weeks has been primarily due to the interest rate cut from the US Federal Reserve. That's caused the US dollar to weaken somewhat and brought more interest into gold. Over the longer term, though, there's other factors been at work. We've seen very strong buying from central banks, for example, which doubled the amount of gold they were buying back in 2022 and continue to buy good amounts. And we've seen strong buying from emerging market countries around the world over the last 12 months. So that's the reason why gold was already quite high. With more interest rate cuts expected, that's likely to mean gold can make further ground from here.
Where does most of the world's gold come from?
Well, the largest producing country is China, closely followed by Australia and Russia. But it is mined in a very large number of countries around the world.
How is this price increase going to impact these economies then?
Well, for a large developed economy like Australia, it's not going to have a massive impact. Where the increase in gold price will have the biggest impact is where gold mining makes up a large component of the economy. And that's typically in emerging market countries in Africa and to a certain extent in South America. So there's many countries in Africa, in Ghana, for example, which used to be called the Gold Coast, but also Mali, Cote d'Ivoire, etc., but also countries in South America as well, which produce gold, whereas developing countries, they're not as rich as the big major economies. So it's going to have a much bigger proportional impact on the economies of those countries.
Do you see a ramp up in production then?
Only at the margin. What we will see is we'll see some mining companies able to access maybe some lower quality ores that previously they would have stockpiled and now they may treat. So we're not going to see a big increase in production as a consequence of these higher prices. What we might see, though, is 5, 10, 15 years down the line, is new mines coming into production.
When you look at how this gold is being bought and for what it's being used, is it mainly for an investment purposes that's driving up the demand, or is it also for retail and commercial purposes like making jewelry?
It's a balance. About 35% of mine production goes into jewelry. Something like 40% goes into investment. 7% in industrial applications, particularly technology uses like electronics. And then central banks buy about 20% as well. So there's a good spread of applications for gold. Generally speaking, when we're seeing the gold price at its highs, you can be pretty certain that investors and speculators have been the marginal buyer of gold.
I was speaking to a jeweler from India before, and he said that he's seeing those who are in the middle income group, or the service class as he would define it in India, those people are cutting back on buying jewelry this season because it's costing so much. Households don't have that kind of money. Is that worrying from the demand point of view?
Our experience of jewelry purchases in these big markets like China and India is there is always a slowdown in purchases when the price goes up rapidly. Of course, in India, there's been a huge benefit to consumers in that the government has cut import duties considerably, down 9% at the beginning of July. So that's absorbed quite a lot of the increase in the gold price. And certainly we can see really strong. But no, I mean, the underlying point is valid, is as the gold price goes up, it means gold jewelry is more expensive. And that will hamper, at least in the short term, jewelry demand from some countries. What we tend to find, though, is after a while, buyers get used to higher prices and come back to the markets.
How much of this price increase trickles down to the mining worker, especially in low-income economies that you spoke about earlier?
World Gold Council member companies contributed almost $58 billion to the countries where they operate and employed almost 370,000 workers in mines around the world. We've seen high inflation in the mining sector over the last few years. And part of that has been due to the demands of labor and high wage increases coming through. There's no doubt about it. When the mining companies are making more money, they come under more pressure to give higher wage increases.
That was John Reid, senior market strategist at the World Gold Council. George Conboy continues to be with us. George, so we've seen gold cross about $2,600 per ounce already. What's your forecast?
We expect gold to go higher. Part of the reason is, and it's counterintuitive, as the price goes up of most commodities, you expect less demand. But with investors this year, as the price has risen, we see more investors clamoring for more gold. There's a certain amount of FOMO, fear of missing out. Mm-hmm. So expect another 10% on gold in the near future. That would be my guess.
And as we talk about gold, there's another story which we are talking about just earlier on the BBC, which is about the currency that is backed by gold in Zimbabwe called ZiG. Now, the Zimbabwe Central Bank has devalued it by 40% against the US dollar. What does this mean?
What it means is you can't trust the Zimbabwean currency for about 20 years now. It was a good idea to go toward a gold peg in Zimbabwe, but now with the devaluation, people will have less confidence, and you'll likely see the Zimbabwean currency pick up its old inflationary ways. The future's not good there. If you want gold, buy gold. Don't buy the ZiG.
Well, George Conboy, chairman of Brighton Securities, thank you so much for joining us. More on that story on bbc.co.uk/news. Head there. You've been listening to World Business Report. Check out our podcast as well. See you next time. Namaste.
Schon viel über Kryptowährungen gehört, aber noch keinen richtigen Zugang gefunden? Der Einstieg in Kryptowährungen muss nicht kompliziert sein. Mit Xtrackers ETCs kannst du kostengünstig in die Zukunft investieren. Einfach übers klassische Depot. Auf xtrackers.de findest du viel Wissenswertes zu dieser spannenden Anlageklasse. Nimm deine finanzielle Zukunft selbst in die Hand. Schritt für Schritt mit Xtrackers. Investitionen unterliegen Risiken. Dieser Beitrag ist eine Werbemitteilung der DWS International GmbH, Frankfurt.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.